Martin Tembisile Chris Hani, revolutionary hero whose life was cut short before he could witness the fruits of South African democracy. An MK commander, an ANC fighter, and someone whose fingerprints have left an indelible mark on democratic South Africa, even though he never lived to see it. In this episode, we delve into the importance and the political significance of the life of Chris Hani.
One is not surprised that a number of our activists at a branch and regional level either have been killed or attempts have been made to kill them. And I think it's going to continue. And we must expect that attempts will be made to eliminate us or even to kill leaders of the Communist Party.
Spread the fire. Welcome back to SMWX. And if you're new around here, my name is Sizwe Mbofu-Walsh. And on this channel, we explore South African politics through interviews and analysis. And today, we're taking a step back and looking into history. We recently did a video on Zuma versus Mbeki, which did very well. And many of you said you like the historical angle. So we're taking a step back from the headlines today and looking at the life story of one of the most important South Africans in our nation's history, Chris Hani. Now, before we get going, help us get to 100,000 subscribers by clicking that subscribe button. Our goal is to get to 100,000 subscribers by the election this year. Okay, so Chris Hani is a really important life, a life that probably hasn't been celebrated as much as other important struggle heroes in South Africa. And in today's episode, I'd like to break his life down into four main parts. And by the end of this episode, you will have an understanding of the importance of Hani's life and its context in terms of South African history. So first, we'll look at Hani's early life and the forces which shaped him. Then, second, we're going to look at his becoming a young revolutionary, someone who even criticized his own party. Then we get the phase third of his emergence into a true ANC leader, someone who's establishing himself, especially within MK, as a leading voice. And then finally, his conversion from leader into icon and his ultimate assassination. So let's get into it. All right, so let's try to understand the early life of what would become Chris Hani. He's born Martin Tembisile Hani. He only gets the name Chris later and will explain how that name comes about. But he's born in rural Eastern Cape in the then Transkei in Tofimvaba in a place called Sabalele. And a lot of interesting things are happening at the time of his birth. He's born in 1942. And what's fascinating is that that is the same year that Jacob Zuma and Thabo Mbeki were born. So Hani is born in on the 28th of June, 10 days after Thabo Mbeki. So this was clearly an auspicious date for South African leaders. And of course, Jacob Zuma was also born on the 12th of April that year. So in a very narrow window, these three South African leaders are born and their life trajectories are going to come together at different times as well. Now, before Hani's born, we need to understand the context of 1942 as well. So in 1942, remember, the Second World War is waging. And actually, Germany is reaching its high point in the Second World War as it's about to embark on an incursion into Russian territory, into Soviet Union territory at the time. And the Battle of Stalingrad is about to ensue. So this is really the high point of Germany's campaign in the Second World War. And it's not clear at that time whether the forces of Nazism or the Allied forces will prevail in the Second World War. So Hani's born right into a key moment of world history. Before he's born, of course, in 1912, the ANC has been founded. And this is a key moment in the liberation movement's history. This is very early in the ANC's history, though, of course. We think of the ANC as a 100-year-old organization now, but then at the time of his birth, only 30 or so years old. And of course, the SACP is also founded in 1921. So these organizations are established, but still relatively new in terms of their history. Now, Hani is then born, and again, in this period, another important figure is born 4 years later, and that is Steve Biko. So Biko was born in 1946, a few years after Haini, Zuma, and Mbeki. So that situates us roughly in time with where we are with Haini's birth. And then let's move on to some of the important things that shaped Haini as a child and as a student before he becomes a member of MK. Okay, well, of course, what also happens at a key time in Haini's life as he's about to turn six is that the National Party comes to power and apartheid begins in earnest. So you can see all these things that are happening around Haini as his early life is coming into view. Second World War starts, then just about ends. Apartheid begins. The National Party comes to power. And of course, this creates a crisis, particularly in the life of Black South Africans. Not only have they fought in the Second World War and contributed greatly to the defeat of Nazism, but now the country turns around and places them in a position of terrible oppression. And liberation movements like the ANC, like all other kinds of liberation movements at the time, are deeply shocked that the condition of Black South Africans has got to this crisis point. And so, of course, in reaction to that, as Haini grows up, the more vigorous reaction to apartheid starts happening. So we get the Defiance Campaign, we get great opposition to the Bantu Education Act, and ANC resistance shifts from being more passive in its nature to being much more confrontational in terms of protest towards the apartheid state. And this is shaping Haini in his early life. So the Defiance Campaign is happening when he was 11, and then the movement towards the Freedom Charter comes in when he turns 13. And then when he turns 14, the treason trial in 1956. And of course, this is a key moment in South African history, but also in Haini's life, because think of all the political court cases that we watch today. It was exactly the same at that time, only more intense. And these court cases really caught the imagination of people. And in the treason trial, you got to see people like Mandela, like Sisulu, really becoming heroes in the minds of those who were intent on resisting apartheid. So this new, more energetic, more forceful, more confrontational form of struggle was happening as Haini was becoming 13, 14 years old, and it really left an important mark on him. He attends the school Lovedale, which we've spoken about on this channel, a really important institution where lots of liberation figures passed through. And then at the age of 16, and by the way, it becomes clear that Haini is an extremely intelligent young man. He matriculates at 16, and he's got an eye for literature and also for languages. And he eventually then goes to Fort Hare, the university, when he turns 17. Now, this is at a time, as I say, when there is great ferment in South African politics. And when he goes to Fort Hare, there's a big fight over the extension of University Education Act. And this is really where the apartheid government further tries to segregate and separate races within South African universities. And whereas it had been possible for a small number of Black students to attend what were thought of as white institutions, the apartheid government really starts cracking down and separating and segregating Black students out of those institutions. And so this catches Haini's attention, and he takes part in protests around this. And soon after this, we start seeing, we're now moving into the 1960s from the 1950s, as Haini is turning 18, coming of age, we start to see the formation and the talk about whether the struggle needs to move not just from protest, but towards violent and armed struggle. And eventually we see the formation of underground structures leading to military wings. And Haini is very keen at this time. And remember, he's just at university, he's young, he's in his late teens, early 20s, eventually is very keen to join Umkhonto weSizwe, which he does. MK is founded in 1961, Haini becomes a member and takes an important role after his graduation in MK underground structures, particularly in the Western Cape, where he has by this time moved because he's starting his articles in a law firm, having obtained his degree in classics and languages at Fort Hare. So that's really where we get to the point that Heine has now decided to become a true revolutionary freedom fighter. His life is born into a generation of important ANC leaders, that next generation after the Mandelas and Sisulus and Tambos, that next layer of leadership, the Bikors, the Mbekis, the Zumas, etc. And he is now in a moment where the struggle is taking on a new momentum and shifting into a new gear. And in his early 20s, he's ready to embark on a new chapter in his life. So let's see how that chapter unfolds. Okay, so we come on to chapter 2, which is Heine as a young radical. Now, as we've said, he's just finished university, he's joined MK, and the struggle is heating up as the ANC decides to pursue military as well as political struggle. Now, in 1962, this becomes a really key year for Heine. He's about 20, and a number of different things happen. So he is detained for the first time. He's found at a roadblock with ANC sympathetic material which was actually related to the 90-day detention law, so where people could be detained without trial. Ironically, because he has material that is sympathetic to the ANC against that law, he then goes into detention. And ultimately, there's a legal process through this detention where he goes out on bail, he comes back, he gets detained again, and eventually gets sentenced to 18 months. Interestingly, he's represented by Albie Sachs, the now former Constitutional Court judge, and the two have an interesting relationship in their life. They meet later in Maputo, later in Heine's life. So the decision that the ANC takes is that there's no use having Heine in jail and that it's time for him to go underground because he has received this sentence. And then Heine is confronted with a decision, and he does take this decision on the advice of the ANC that he's going to go underground and he's ultimately going to go into military training and exile outside South Africa. So eventually, towards the end of this year, he leaves South Africa via Botswana and then ultimately makes his way to a really formative period in his life. He goes for military training in the Soviet Union.
For most of us, this was the realization of what dreams as young combatants we had been given very, very, you know, thorough training in the Soviet Union. And we had undergone a lot of physical and military preparations in Zambia because we established a special camp in Zambia to prepare ourselves both physically, mentally, and militarily.
Just imagine you're at the age of 21, apartheid is underway, you've been arrested, you could go to jail, and you really take the decision that you're going to become a military commander to fight a revolutionary war back in South Africa. That's serious stuff. And Heine makes his way to the Soviet Union and undergoes military training. He learned about the theory of guerrilla warfare. He learned about how to commit acts of sabotage. He learned about various Marxist forms of understanding history and understanding combat. So he's really becoming, in some ways, a hardened military revolutionary, or at least he's learning the theory and the training of how to do that. So he thinks he's just going to go for 6 months, but he ends up for about a year in the Soviet Union. And he eventually comes back and returns from the Soviet Union. And now he's about 22 or so, and we can see that his life is shaping up to be in MK and in MK camps in Africa, particularly in Zambia, which is where he returns. And he's a young man, he's training, but early on he starts to get a little frustrated that he's not in South Africa. He's, of course, in Zambia, in other parts of Africa. And there's a lot of training happen, but there's not a lot of contact with the actual enemy, let alone going back into South Africa and actually leading MK operations there. And so early on, he starts to become a bit frustrated with his position and the strategy of MK. But he ultimately builds up, and along with a number of other MK cadres, convinces the movement that they need to form an alliance with ZIPRA. This is this important revolutionary army, the equivalent of MK in Zimbabwe. This was the revolutionary army that was connected to ZAPU. ZAPU was one of the two national liberation movements in Zimbabwe. Kind of like you had the ANC and the PAC in Zimbabwe, you also had ZAPU and ZANU. ZANU ultimately becoming what would later become ZANU-PF, etc. But ZAPU was actually, in the early phases, the key ally of the ANC, and their army, the equivalent of MK, was ZIPRA. You might have heard that in the well-known Dubulibhunu song, ZIPRA Mkhonto Alliance. That's where that comes from. ZIPRA was the Zimbabwe revolutionary MK equivalent, and Mkhonto obviously was MK, so ZIPRA Mkhonto Alliance. So he convinces many in the leadership, along with others, that there needs to be this alliance between the two fighting groups. And ultimately, he starts forming a plan where he wants MK to really start engaging the enemy and starting to make incursions into South Africa. And this is what becomes the Wanki Sipolilo campaign. So the idea is they are going to go from Zambia, which of course has a border with Zimbabwe, which is very close to Botswana as well. So kind of where those three countries meet, Botswana, Zimbabwe in the south, and Zambia north of them. And this campaign is going to be an incursion from Zambia into Zimbabwe. And they're going to go to a place called the Wanki Game Reserve. And from there, they're going to split up, and one group is going to go down south towards South Africa, and the other group is going to turn eastwards towards Botswana and to try and create networks of intelligence and solidarity along that route. So this is really the first time that Heine and many of his comrades actually engage in a physical battle which targets the enemy as they saw it. And all reports say that Heine was extremely brave in this encounter. He was one of the first people in his canoe to go across. So to get from Zambia to Zimbabwe, they had to cross a gorge, which had some water. Apparently, some accounts even say they were crocodiles that they had to make it past. And he was the first person to try and cross the gorge. And apparently, at the other side of the gorge, he looked back at his comrades and was doing push-ups and celebrating. Anyway, they made it across. They crossed the river, which was also a border crossing, and they made it all the way to the Wanki Game Reserve, where they then broke up. And along the way, though, three people got lost, and Rhodesian forces tortured them and managed to extract intelligence from them, which alerted Rhodesian forces to their presence. And ultimately, this is a really interesting moment, and we could actually have a whole episode just about the Wanki campaign, but they got caught, they fought back, they made the Rhodesian forces run away a couple of times, but ultimately they decided that they had to perform a strategic retreat, and some people got killed, others got injured, and others made their way to the Botswana border, where they decided that they would strategically not resist arrest, they were promised that they wouldn't be detained, but ultimately they got detained, and Heine spent a period in jail in Botswana. The Botswana government was under a lot of pressure from the apartheid government not to allow MK combatants to make this trail from Zambia down into South Africa, which was the ultimate purpose of the Wanki campaign. So on the one hand, it was a failure in the sense that they didn't create that trail, and they weren't able to create a kind of Ho Chi Minh trail from Zambia into South Africa, where MK could actually make their way from Zambia and actually do operations in South Africa. They got stopped before they could do it, but they demonstrated that they could actually engage, and they could engage in battles that made certain strategic advances. But they were also detained, and Hani now finds himself in jail in Botswana, and this becomes quite a low point for his life. And so he actually spends 2 years in jail, and he was given promises that the ANC and various other forces would try to get him out early, and he really feels quite abandoned in jail. He's the one who has actually been brave enough to create this battle. They're captured, and he feels he's in some ways been let down and abandoned. And he wonders why MK isn't doing more to actually engage the enemy. And so when he eventually emerges from jail, he is the most radical Hani that we get to see. And not necessarily just radical against apartheid, but radical against his own movement, the ANC. He comes out swinging and ultimately is one of the authors of what becomes known as the Hani Memorandum. And this is a stinging letter to the leadership of the ANC. The president of the ANC by this time is Oliver Tambo, where Hani and others say that the movement has lost its way, people are becoming corrupt, they're driving luxury cars in Lusaka and in Zambia, they're going on all these international trips and starting to become lost in just being a professional liberation organization, but not actually doing the hard and dangerous work of addressing militarily the apartheid government. And it's a fascinating document. You should read it. It's available online. And Hani is really part of that noble tradition within South African politics of people criticizing the liberation movement from within. And this has always happened, and this is a very important tradition in South Africa. There have always been people who criticize the liberation movement. And it's a tradition which is really important today because we often feel like we owe something to the ANC and we can't criticize the ANC. But some of its greatest leaders have been its greatest critics. And the Hani Memorandum is an example of when the liberation movement, not just the ANC, goes wayward, there are those voices to bring it back to its ultimate purpose. But the ANC doesn't take very kindly to this. And there are lots of disciplinary processes. And it's not clear whether Hani and those authors of the memorandum are even going to be allowed into the ANC. And it takes a lot of negotiation. And there's ultimately a meeting with Tambo where they come together. But the fact is that the Hani memorandum lights a fire under ANC leaders. And even though they aren't able to, Hani and those who authored the memorandum aren't able to attend what becomes a key conference where the ANC tries to self-correct and gets itself out of its malaise, the Hani memorandum is key to creating that sense of self-reflection. And the ANC ultimately goes to a conference, the famous Morogoro conference in Morogoro in 1969. And this is a conference where it's seen that the ANC is able to have a look at itself and say, something's not right. We need to redouble our efforts towards struggle. We need to listen to those critical voices and find ourselves again. And even though Hani's left out of that conference because he's still in trouble, he was a key part of bringing that conference together. And when the ANC comes out of the Morogoro conference, as we go into chapter 3, it is as a new organization, and it's an organization which Hani feels he can again contribute all his efforts to. And that's where we see Hani going from the young radical into the ANC leader who establishes himself as a commander within MK. So let's go to chapter 3, where Hani asserts his leadership within the MK and rises through the ranks of the ANC to the point where he later becomes one of its most famous faces. Okay, so let's come to chapter 3 of Hani's life as ANC leader. Now, Morogoro's happened, the ANC is somewhat reformed, and Hani has a new intensity for his life within MK. He's now becoming a more senior leader, and the ANC is sending him as a representative on various trips and to various places. So, for example, in 1972, when he turns 30, you can see he's becoming an older man now. He goes on a trip to Sweden, where he represents the ANC, and of course the ANC's alliances with Scandinavian countries come from those early moments where they would go on these trips and try to convince these Scandinavian countries of the evil of apartheid, something which was very successful in the end. He attended OAU conferences on behalf of the ANC and in some cases even re-entered South Africa. He spent time in what was then the German Democratic Republic. And so we started to see Ahani, who was actually becoming a representative of the ANC, starting to establish his international footprint. And in 1974, he also marries Dimpo Hani, his wife, in Lusaka. So as he becomes an older man, entering his early 30s, he's ultimately deployed as the ANC's chief representative in Lesotho. And this becomes a really important deployment because the Mountain Kingdom becomes a place where it's separate from South Africa, but within South Africa. And Hani really starts building an MK network of the angry students of 1976 and that generation who want to take their militancy from the streets actually into MK and into liberation armies. And so Hani is tasked at that very important time in South Africa's history as the 1976 uprisings are happening. He's building a network of new, younger, more revolutionary MK cadres that are coming in. He's bringing them in, introducing them to the literature, introducing them to military strategy and MK strategy. And then ultimately they go on from Lesotho to different parts of the MK network. So that's the role that Hani really plays from the mid-70s. Of course, at this time, Biko is rising as an important leader. Then Biko is assassinated. And black consciousness and a more radical politics, while the ANC is still in some ways very far away from the struggle, is taking place. Remember, ANC leaders are, many of them are in jail, many of them are in exile, etc. No one has seen Mandela for many, many a year. At this time, it's becoming clear that Hani is a really important and a significant leader within MK. And he's slowly starting to rise through the ranks, and his position in Lesotho starts to attract the attention of the apartheid government. Apparently, he would go for a run in the morning, but he would always take a different route on that run to make sure that he couldn't be tracked. And the apartheid government ultimately tries their first assassination attempt on Hani in 1981. This is a car bomb, which explodes outside Hani's house, but he's not actually in the car at the time. And it really shakes Hani, but also his family, who were just shaken up by the fact that this car just outside their house exploded. And you can imagine what that would have done to them. So again, avoids the attack, but is growing and becoming a more influential leader, and ultimately rises and is elected to the ANC NEC now in 1982 at the age of 40. And let's take a step back there again. You know, we've got to this point where ANC leaders have to be like 85 before they're considered for leadership positions these days. But those who actually waged the liberation struggle were really young people. Hani was 21 when he joined MK. 40 when he joined the NEC, and in his 30s was already doing all this important work. And it's just worth noting that history teaches us that it is young people who are at the forefront of struggle, and not just old people who seem only to be at the forefront of government these days. So Hani really establishes himself, rises through the ranks of MK, and his key role in Lesotho becomes a key point for building in a new generation of MK cadres and sending them on from there, and has now established himself as a representative of the ANC, sometimes abroad, and a key leader within the movement. And this really lays the groundwork as the mid-1980s come to a close for his ascension into iconic status, because after this is where Hani really becomes the Hani of myth and the Hani of legend in South Africa. And this is where he comes back to South Africa after this and really is able to articulate himself. People see him for the first time, and he becomes the liberation leader that everyone thought would take over power from Nelson Mandela after Mandela's tenure. So let's go into chapter 4, Icon. Okay, so in the mid-1980s, we really see a sea change in liberation struggle again. The ANC moves on to what it calls a strategy of people's war. And this is about not just MK and sabotage, but the ANC using its considerable knowledge, underground structures and infrastructure to facilitate mass protest at home. So, of course, you see the rise of the UDF, you see the rise of that moment of rolling mass struggle, and the ANC is also playing a key role in this, maybe not as the forefront organization, but as an organization that's using its means and its mechanisms, even while it's banned in South Africa, to build a sense of full frontal and full-throated protest action in South Africa. And Heinie plays a key role in the ANC and the NEC, negotiating towards the need for the ANC to play this role, to really build and ferment protest within South Africa. And within that protest, that can create fertile ground for MK as well, but also will put great pressure on the apartheid government. And so we see from about 1985 onwards, when the ANC again, in and around that period, has a really important conference, that they move on to this people's war strategy. And slowly but surely, this is when the tide of international opinion begins to turn. This is when a lot of protest really starts to build, and when the apartheid government starts to crack down on dissent and really make itself very unpopular in international media. And so we see states of emergency, we see crackdowns, we see detentions, we see the tide beginning to turn against apartheid. We see sanctions coming into the picture. And many people thought at that time that P.W. Botha, who then became prime minister, would start negotiations, but he holds out, and this only further puts pressure on the apartheid government. So we then get to the point where de Klerk takes over from P.W. Botha. The people's war strategy is rolling. Protest against apartheid is just reaching new levels in the late 80s. And ultimately, out of nowhere, de Klerk announces that Mandela will be released, that the ANC will be, SACP as well, will be unbanned, and we get the process towards negotiations. Now, Heinie plays a really important role here, and it's often seen that his voice is the voice that we needed after democracy, because he argued for a much more radical economic policy than the one that the ANC ultimately followed. So before we get there, Heinie is then able to permanently return to South Africa. And that must have been an incredible moment for him when you think about it. He really formally left in his early 20s. And now at the age of like 59, he's actually able to formally return to South Africa. And sorry, at the age of about 40, 49. So he's been away for a really long time. And he gets to come home, and he comes home at a time when the ANC is effectively starting to negotiate with the apartheid government, a step that he's not too fond of. And he seems to think that there are various ANC leaders who are too keen to negotiate, when he believes that armed struggle should still be pursued and that there are more concessions that can be extracted from apartheid before negotiations happen. So he becomes one of those voices cautioning against negotiating too early. And in the 1990s then, some important decisions get taken. So the decision to suspend armed struggle happens. And Heinie talks about how this moment brought him to tears. In fact, he speaks about how he was unable to sleep when he knew that the ANC was negotiating with the National Party. And when it was finally announced that the armed struggle, which he had given many decades of his life to, would be suspended, he saw this as premature. And nonetheless, he still had to find the maturity to agree publicly with the decision and with the leadership. And he speaks a lot about how difficult that decision was for him. So the armed struggle is suspended, negotiations have started, and then the ANC has a series of really important conferences. 1991, they elect new leadership. And remember, Tambo, who's been president for a really long time, is now in the process of his later years. And Mandela starts to rise as president of the ANC and starts to become that key figure within the ANC and ultimately within the government and the country. Hani is actually the most popular person at this 1991 conference. Fun fact, I was actually at the 1991 conference. My mom was a delegate to the conference and she took me there as a two-year-old. So that's an interesting fun fact. But so Hani is elected with the most votes at that conference. So it's clear that within the ANC, he is now seen as one of the most popular figures. One of the other most popular figures was Thabo Mbeki. And Hani and Mbeki enjoyed an interesting rivalry throughout their political careers, sometimes coming together, sometimes disagreeing. So, for example, it's said that they disagreed on negotiations. Mbeki saw negotiations as much more urgent, whereas Hani disagreed that they needed to happen as urgently. And in the Hani memorandum, Hani actually criticized Mbeki all those years ago and actually named him in the Hani memorandum. So, but at other times they were together. So they had an interesting rivalry. And of course, they were born in the same year. So kind of similar to Zuma and Mbeki in that way. Anyway, so Hani becomes the most popular figure in the ANC, basically after Nelson Mandela. And it's clear that he has a lot of public support as well. People just resonate with Hani and his message. And he seems to embody the best of the liberation movement. He also, though, takes on an increasingly important role as General Secretary of the South African Communist Party. And instead of rising through the ranks of the ANC, he decides that he really wants to dedicate his time to the Communist Party because he feels that that's been neglected. And so when South Africa goes to CODESA and those important negotiations, Hani's there, but he's actually there representing the Communist Party, not the ANC. Formally, of course, they have a relationship anyway. But again, at CODESA, Hani's making much more radical proposals and is to the more to the radical side of the ANC, which is trying to find consensus. The Communist Party is always saying no, but we need to go that one step further, especially on the economy, questions like nationalization and state control in the economy. So in the ensuing years, Hani really cements himself because people can finally see him. He's giving speeches. He's going around the country, Eastern Cape, Western Cape. He's going around the world as a spokesperson for the ANC. You can see some really interesting speeches he gives when he goes to the United States. He did like an event with the well-known activist Angela Davis. He went on various TV programs in the United States and really acquitted himself well and distinguished himself as one of the most articulate advocates for the liberation movement. It really started to become clear that Hani was going to become one of the leaders of the next generation, and that after Mandela and Sisulu and Tambo and Kathrada, he was really first in line, maybe along with the likes of Mbeki, to be and Ramaphosa, to be one of those new frontline leaders, and more than any of the others because of his history in MK and because of how much public and ANC support he had, it became clear that he was probably going to be the president, or he could well have been the president of South Africa, or at least of the ANC if he wanted to, after Mandela. And Mandela was making it clear that he only wanted to serve one term because he was getting older at that point as well. So many people imagined that Hani would be one of the candidates who would take over that next level of leadership and maybe consolidate it into the democratic era. But at the height, tragically, of this moment of transition, and just over 1 year before South Africa became a democracy and we held our democratic elections, Hani was assassinated. And this assassination was one of the saddest moments in the entire liberation struggle because someone who had dedicated their life for so long died on the eve of democracy and all that had been fought for.
We are a nation in mourning. our pain and anger is real. Yet we must not permit ourselves to be provoked by those who seek to deny us the very freedom Chris Hani gave his life for.
He was assassinated outside his home in Boksburg. And this assassination is a story on its own. A lot of mystery surrounds the assassination. And ultimately, Janusz Walusz and Clive Darby Lewis are held accountable for the murder, for having planned the murder. And they ultimately get sentenced to jail, and they go to jail. They applied for amnesty and all of that. But this story is not so much about them. Maybe I'll do another video. Comment down below if you want to do a video about the aftermath of Hani's life and all the cases, because we know that recently Walusz himself was actually granted parole by the Constitutional Court, a controversial decision that many people disagreed with at the time. But this video is really about Hani's life. And when Hani died and when he was assassinated, many people thought that negotiations would stop and it would actually lead possibly to a civil war. And many accounts of this period suggest that we were close. The closest we came to civil war was when Hani was assassinated, because people were so angry, not only that he died, but that clearly the forces of apartheid wanted to eliminate Hani from the future South Africa, because his voice was so powerful, because his perspective was relatively radical. It was clearly realized that if you could extract that voice from the ANC side, then you would significantly weaken the ANC and you could maybe turn it in a less radical direction. And so in many ways, Hani is seen as the embodiment of what could have been. As the ANC in democracy has lost its way and moved away from truly radically shifting South African economic relations towards really preserving and in some ways consolidating an apartheid-like economy, people often wonder whether a voice like Hani could have lived up to the hopes of the ANC to truly change people's lives. Towards the end of his life, he was talking a lot about the importance of education, the importance of eradicating poverty. And as we end this video, I'd like to leave you with an interesting quotation from Hani as he was beginning to realize that corruption would ultimately affect the ANC and that the ANC needed to shift away from a lifestyle of corruption. So we could talk more about the effects of Hani's life. Let me know down in the comments if you'd like that. But this video is really a salute to Chris Hani. It's an attempt to get a new generation to understand his life, the context of his life, and the role he played as a liberation fighter, and the terrible tragedy of South Africa losing Hani right at the moment when we most needed him. So spread the fire, like, share, subscribe. Let me know which other people you'd like me to do this kind of biography of. And as we close out this episode, we will read a quote from Chris Hani, which is really a premonition of what could be to come in the South Africa of the future. Ayeye. I think, finally, the ANC will have to fight a new enemy. That enemy would be another struggle to make freedom and democracy worthwhile to ordinary South Africans. Our biggest enemy would be what we do in the field of socio-economic restructuring, creation of jobs, building of houses, schools, medical facilities, overhauling our education, eliminating illiteracy, building a society which cares and fighting corruption, and moving into the gravy train of using power, government positions to enrich individuals. We must build a different culture in this country, different from Africa, different from the Nationalist Party. And that culture should be one of service to people. Some of us, especially as we enter the party, have been discussing how we should cut down the salaries of ministers, of parliamentarians, and all the subsidies, so that if you're in Parliament in Cape Town or Pretoria, you actually rent a flat like everybody. We are thinking in terms of a number of guidelines so that those people who go to Parliament or go into government should be those who are prepared to serve the people, not because it is a way of enriching people. And I think the ANC, therefore, must now position itself to tackle the problems of grassroots people. And that is why the ANC must allow the formation of many democratic formations in this country, organs of civil society like the civics, independent trade unions, students' organizations, teachers' organizations, organizations of housewives, women's, gays, and everybody else, so that it is kept reminded of the need of the new people on the ground. 1993.